We turned and read in Esther chapter 8. Let us turn back there. We've been working through the story, seeking to learn as we go. And we come now to chapter 8, as the chapter would have reminded you. Haman, the great enemy of the Jews, of Mordecai first, and of the Jews, he had gone too far, and he had been punished. He had been hanged by the king. Esther, on the other hand, hasn't she done well? She's shown great calm in the face of severe dangers, the danger to her people when it was first discovered, the danger that was still some months away, the danger to herself. She had to approach the king, as she made very plain to Mordecai. It was a hazardous journey itself, not guaranteed at all to gain or to keep her life, even though she was a favoured queen. And then, too, the way that she went about raising the particular matter, the two banquets of chapter 5 and chapter 7, it was quite a calmer. She carried it off with great aplomb. Facing these two men, the king and Haman, and their the character of them that is being revealed in the snippets we've seen of them, there's no telling what they might have done, and yet she stands firm. Now, so far, so good. She's been able to set back Haman himself. He had set a scheme in place, and but he himself would not be there to see it brought to fruition. He's gone. He's dead. And it would appear that having accomplished that, the end of chapter 7 says, then the king's wrath subsided. It would appear that the king was satisfied that he had dealt with the main problem. But do you remember what happened in chapter 7, that it was Esther saying, it's me and my people who are in danger. And then as the king was fuming outside the room when he came back, Haman had in some way fallen across the queen as she was reclining at the table, and it only made matters worse. And once Haman had been hanged, the king's wrath subsided. But we know, and Esther was very clear on this, that the greater danger still hangs over the Jews, and herself therefore included. How could she escape? Haman was dead, but his works continued after him. So what else needs to happen, and what will happen in this story? The edict that had gone out and under the king's name by Haman's devising said that the Jews would be killed, destroyed, and annihilated. If one was not enough, he was making sure that there was no escape. Right through all the provinces, from India to Ethiopia, the provinces of this great empire. What's going to happen? Will this happen? Will the Jews suffer by this directive across the provinces? The Jews, as God's people, is God caring for them? Things that we are presented with in chapter 8, I think we might sum them up in this way. First of all is to remember the wider danger. It's not just to Esther in the immediate presence of Haman, but there is a wider danger. There is also, therefore, a second circular that we read of in this chapter, and this presents a provision against evil. So just to reflect on this story, this part of the story under these headings. First of all then, the wider danger. The king's wrath was subsided, and Esther, in the opening verses of this chapter 8 through to really to verse 6, tells us of what Esther said to the king when she came back into his throne room. Why does the king need to be addressed like this? Esther has already said to him at the second banquet, my life is forfeit, my people's lives are forfeit. We're in danger of elimination. But the king's wrath had subsided. What was he doing about it? And he does show himself most of the time in this book as a man who really doesn't seem to see very much more than what's right in front of him, whether it's brought to him by his attendants, his counselors, or certain events that we've been reading about. He was most definitely furious with Haman initially in chapter 7, but remember, Esther had mentioned her people, and that seems to have very quickly faded from his mind. And so it is in chapter 8, in those early verses, that Esther begins to renew her campaign on their behalf, although in a new way. She has greater help, I guess you might say. She has Mordecai in the king's closest circle as well now, her own cousin who had been so close to her in her youth. And they have, you would assume that Mordecai had a part in this too, but they have found a way to go further and to deal with the remaining problem. Haman's plot is still out there. The calendar is flipping over towards that 13th day of the 12th month. And everyone else in 127 provinces, Haman is dead, but everyone else was free to plan their attacks and stockpile their weapons to wipe out the Jews. And the Jews could do nothing about it. Still, at this point, whichever way they turned, however far they might have gone within this empire, they would still be under threat of death, every single one of them. We don't learn very much, but just a couple of verses tell us very quickly, the beginning of the chapter, how with Haman gone, Mordecai takes his place. He's shown himself to be wise. He has a close relation to the queen, and her own wisdom perhaps rubs off in the king's mind at least. But Mordecai has also shown himself to care for the king. Remember how he made known the plot of those two men who were going to kill the king. So put all of this together, and the king sees fit to give that royal authority into Mordecai's hand. He gives his signet ring. It's only the king himself who is greater than Mordecai now. We also read in those early verses that Haman's house, because Haman had been seen to be the king's enemy, his property became the property of the king, which he duly gave to Esther. And it did strike me that the king was very generous in his protestations when Esther was still going to ask him. The king said, I'll give you anything up to half my kingdom. Well, it seems like this saved him half his kingdom by giving what Haman had lost. He could just pass that on. And Esther chooses to, not only was Mordecai over the empire in the name of the king, but he's also over the house of Haman. A massive reversal in the relationship between these two men. And then Esther comes from verse 3 to verse 6 particularly. She comes and makes her second appearance at the throne. Do you remember the first one where she said to Mordecai, I might die unless I'm invited by the king? But she takes the chance, she goes, she appears in the outer court where the king can see her, and he gives a signal that she's acceptable by extending the scepter. And that happens again here in verse 4 as she approaches. Now it would appear that she has already spoken to the king in verse 3, but treat that as a summary introduction as to what is happening, what's going to happen in the following verses. It just gathers it together. She spoke to the king, fell down, implored him with tears to counteract the evil plot to act against the evil plot of Haman, the Agagite, which he had devised against the Jews. And then she returns to very formal language, appropriate for the occasion, in the throne room, verse 5, if it pleases the king, using the third person of the king, appropriate for that setting, and offers a solution. It's there in summary initially in verse 5, let it be written, and right in the middle of the verse, let it be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman. Pull it back. Turn back the clock. Behave as though it never happened. Annul that decree. But that kind of revoking is not possible. The king says it a little later on in verse 8. He says, you send out another decree and put the king's signet, mark it with the king's signet ring, because then no one can revoke it. But that's exactly what has happened with Haman's decree earlier. It had the mark of the signet ring. It could not be simply pulled, returned in the 9 months remaining. Extra biblical records outside the Bible of this period, and the historian Herodotus wrote in great detail of this very time. And no one can find a specific reference to this. Elsewhere it's called the Law of the Medes and the Persians, where it is set out a decree from the king and it cannot be turned back. We read of it in Daniel, don't we? It doesn't appear anywhere else, but it does appear here, it does appear in Daniel. Is it really the case? Was this the case with the Persians and so on? Well, for a start, it would mean great loss of face for such a king. How could he have decreed something? That was his mind. How could he change his mind? A king of this kind doesn't do that. So there is perhaps that kind of weight of this statement. Maybe it's the king himself who says, well, once I put my stamp on it, I'm not going to pull it back. In the case of Daniel, it was the other officials who came to the king and said, put it in the law of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be revoked. Was that the fawning, the pandering officials trying to puff up the king? Say, this is the kind of rule that you will pass. It doesn't need to be changed. So that's just a little light on this situation, that where Esther asks for the letters to be revoked, it can't simply be said, well, that's null and void. It doesn't happen. It's not going to happen that way. There had to be a different kind of approach. This that Haman had set in place was airtight. There was no escape from it. And then comes the king. He makes a response. In verse 7, the king says, indeed, I have given Esther the house of Haman, and they have hanged him on the gallows because he tried to lay his hands on the Jews. Now, it would almost appear that the king is really just pontificating. He's making a big statement to show that he's got everything straight. He knows how it's all working. I've been on top of this all along. It would almost be comic if it wasn't so serious to the Jews. But as a result of that, he gives the permission. You go ahead. You write the decree. Does anyone remember something like that before? It's exactly what he said to Haman. You've got an idea. You want to deal with some people. Go ahead. Do it. You just do it. Put my stamp on it. That's fine. He's saying the same thing. And the result is then this. I would call it a supplementary directive. The old one is still there. It's not taken away. It can't be taken away. It's unchanged. Something has to be added to it, a supplement that makes the change. And the king leaves it to Esther and Mordecai to come up with the solution. And that brings us to the second circular from verse It begins, the permission for it is begins in verse 8, but then it's explained, outlined from verse 9 onwards. But from verse 7 and the following verses, you do get that almost exact mirror image. Or you might say, well, if Haman's was the negative, this is the positive, if you think of an image. It's almost a straight exchange from Mordecai as compared with Haman. In verse 8, there was that freedom to legislate in the king's name. Then there was the work of the scribes from verse 9 onwards. There was the detail of the plan for circulation. It talks about the officials, it talks about the provinces, 127 of them. It talks about the peoples, all the peoples in their languages, and includes the Jews with their script and language. It talks about, in verse 10, it talks about sending these letters out by couriers on horseback, and the very best of the horses. It's a very close overlap, except for the terms that are contained within it from verse 11 onwards. The new decree that works out to be 2.5 months roughly after the first one, the dates that are given. We have a new permission. The first was an instruction. Chapter 3, verse 13 says, this is what you must do to the people of the provinces. Those people among you, the Jews, you have to eliminate them. As I say, that one remains in force at this point. But there is a new permission goes out. And that parallel, that likeness between the two, shows that this has it's on the same scale. And that's reinforced all the more when you do come down to the terms of this second circular, which are given to us in verse 11. Verse 11 is introduced by these letters. The king permitted the Jews who were in every city to gather together and protect their lives, and this in particular to destroy, kill, and annihilate. And those, do you remember those words? They were there in Haman's directive. But this is what you must do to the Jews. And now it is turned back. The Jews have permission to do at the same level, to destroy, kill, and annihilate. But who? Who are they dealing with? It's the people, the forces of any people or province who would assault them, who would follow through on Haman's first directive against the Jews. To destroy, kill, and annihilate all the forces of any people or province that would assault them, little children and women, and to plunder their possessions. This is the second circular. Couldn't take away the first one, but this is something of a reversal, or it's that supplement I've talked about, an overlay, which gives an opportunity for the Jews to save themselves, as it were. And this is what I'm calling the provision against evil. Many will come to verse 11 and will see what's given to the Jews to do. Destroy, kill, annihilate those who would assault you, both little children and women, and plunder their possessions. Let me leave aside plundering their possessions, because chapter 9 tells us the Jews did not do that. They did rise up armed, but they did not plunder. It's the rest, perhaps, that seems a bit extreme. Yes, there's that directive out there that you could be destroyed and annihilated, but isn't it a bit much for the Jews to be allowed to do the same? And to see that in response, the Jews in the kingdom, they responded with verse 16, light and gladness, joy and honor, even honor amongst the people. In, for example, verse 15, the city of Shushan rejoiced. Not just the Jews there, but the city rejoiced. And they had joy and gladness, a feast and a holiday when they heard this news. And some have suggested this is not a very good reflection on the Jews. But for a start, let's put ourselves in their position. It's only 9 months away, and everyone else around you has the, not just permission, but a direction from the king that they should be putting you to death. You have nowhere at all to escape. It's hardly surprising that they were rejoicing when now they had some respite. There was permission to self-defense, nothing more, but they had the freedom to fight in self-defense. The terms of verse 11 tell us they were permitted. It was allowed, it was not directed that they should attack others. It was that they should protect their lives. But to do it, they were that protection was to be by destruction, even annihilation, those who would assault you. So it's very limited. It's within limits. It's also up to others to make the first move. If no one attacked the Jews, then they would not move against anyone else. They had no permission to do that. It was within very strict limits. It's interesting, too, that there were other people around them who saw this. There was the city of Shushan rejoiced. They gave honor to the Jews. And it tells us in verse 17 that many of the people of the land became Jews, because fear of the Jews fell upon them. They saw this remarkable turnaround. How can this be? And it stirred up within them a sense of, we need to make sure that we ourselves are secure. Even although there was still the possibility that the Jewish people, and they now identified as Jews, that the Jewish people could be attacked. I'm also reminded very much of the Exodus. The Exodus, when the Egyptians had suffered all the plagues, and particularly the last one, and then Israel was finally released and sent out of Egypt, there was a mixed multitude came with them. They abandoned their places in Egypt, and they joined themselves to Israel. These people were aware that the Jews had a God, and they were becoming aware that this God of Israel was not to be trifled with. And so there were people around them who were sympathetic at the very least, who rejoiced with them, some who aligned themselves as Jews. It was up to the others whether or not they would attack the Jews, assault them, and whether their own lives were therefore safe as well, and the lives of their little children and their womenfolk. So there is a new decree goes out. It negates the first in a way. It's at least comparable. Perhaps it's even stronger. Just a few days before this went out, before it was publicized in Shushan, just a few days before, who would have become a Jew? But now some did become Jews. This was a transforming decree. Even though they might yet be attacked 9 months from now. What the Jews do with this is told us in chapter 9, and it tells us that they did have, there was conflict, which suggests there were still some people who wanted to harm them. This was still the spirit that was out there amongst many. Thousands attacked the Jews and lost their lives in chapter 9. I'm setting the scene because it goes some way towards pointing out that we should grasp another element of God's work through this episode of Esther. There are ways in which the book is a puzzle, particularly because God is not mentioned, nor is faith, nor is prayer. None of those things are stated openly. And many people that write on it will talk about providence, and it tells us about the way that God is overruling, directing things. There's too many coincidences, you might say. And these people who become Jews are sensitive to that. They're saying there's something going on here, there's somebody at work. And so that's a very important part of it. But perhaps it's driving us even further, and these two chapters, and chapter 8 is setting the scene for it, there's another vitally important point that God is making in his word here. We do recognize that God is overruling in these matters, but what is he overruling to achieve? What is it about? What is he aiming for? And we would very quickly say, well, isn't he overruling to ensure that the Jews survive? And because the Jews survive, it means that through them can come forth the Messiah, who is the salvation of the nations. That's all good. But could he not have preserved the Jews without Haman ever appearing on the scene? Without Haman's ideas and opposition ever appearing? Why did that have to happen first? Why were the Jews under threat of complete elimination, including Jerusalem and Judea? That was one of the provinces. Couldn't it have been done that way? Why did Haman go so far? Why was he provoked to issue that first decree in the first place? And I do think that it's pointing us towards this, that it's this tension, this conflict that there is existing within the society of this world. And we've sung about it. That there are God's people, and there are those who are against him, and therefore against them as well. God has ruled the affairs of these people, that Haman should be there, that Haman should instigate and perpetrate this evil against God's own people. And God is overruling, but that should then be turned around. There should be a provision in the face of that evil for their protection. And it reminds us, as the Old Testament does, from beginning to end, that God is always dealing with evil in the heart of man. What has happened to Haman? He set himself up against God's people, and therefore against God. And Haman and his line have been destroyed. They've dared to defy God by seeking to eliminate God's chosen people. And perhaps he knew more about it than is laid out for us. He was quite possibly, we're not absolutely certain, but quite possibly, because of his family, Agagites. Takes many of us back to remember the king of the Amalekites, who was Agag. Was he of that family? And the Amalekites were the very first great enemies of Israel, and they never let up through the generations. But Haman and his line were destroyed. Had they set themselves with that history of opposition against God's people? And now we come to the place where that evil has been planted, it's been spread abroad in the wind right across the empire. And anyone who chooses to assault the Jews is more than free to do so. But now the Jews have the opportunity to turn it back on them. The ones who will suffer at the hands of the Jews are only those who choose to do as Haman did. Only those who choose to set themselves against God's people. Only those whose hearts are set to destroy innocents. And so we find that the threat that now looms over them is the same that was meted out on Haman. They too, should they choose to assault the Jews, they too will be destroyed, killed, annihilated, and yes, even their line, their family, Verse 11 doesn't, dare I say it, doesn't really make great sense by including the word both at the end of the verse. It speaks about destroy, kill, annihilate the forces of any people or province that would assault them. And then you might see it's inserted in italics. It is an insertion. But the original Hebrew doesn't read quite that way. It's more just a sequence that those who assault the Jews, along with their own, that is, the forces against the Jews, the people who would attack them, their own families will also suffer, and the plundering of their possessions, as Haman's house was taken from him and his family. If a man chooses to attack a Jew to kill him, he can be killed in turn. The lives of his family are also forfeit with his property. It sounds awful, and it is. But throughout the Old Testament, I mentioned the Amalekites, throughout Israel's story, the attacks of evil were appalling. Look at the times of the judges. How many people came? How was it that the people of Israel survived? Many times those enemies were doing God's work because his people were in need of judgment and punishment. His people were sinners. They needed to be under this kind of pressure that would lead them back to God. But almost invariably, the enemies overreached themselves. Haman's plans were gratuitous violence. He had a grudge against Mordecai, and he wanted to eliminate his people, Mordecai's people. The prophet Habakkuk wrestled with this. He knew that many in Israel were sinners, and he pleaded with God, "How can this sin continue? God, you are righteous and holy. You cannot let this go on." God answered him and said, "I will not let this go on. I have an army coming right now to deal with my sinful people." And a little while later, Habakkuk has seen that army, and he says, "They're even worse. The Babylonians. They're worse. How can that be acceptable, God?" And God says, "No, it's not acceptable either. And they will come to their end too, because they've gone too far. Yes, I do need to deal with my people." Haman was perhaps part of that, in that whole setting. My people are sinners. Is that part of why Esther says has no mention of God? Because people had gone from God. He was just an assumption in the background. But as Habakkuk discovered, it didn't matter who was sinning against God. His own people, or those that were brought in judgment against them. Everyone who oversteps will ultimately bear the consequences. They too will be judged. Israel went too far. The Babylonians went too far. Haman went too far. Many of the people in the provinces were going to go too far. And God had established a way by which they could be resisted. The nations throughout Canaan, from the very beginning, when Joshua led the people in to conquer the land, the nations had reached the fullness of their sin. We're told that. They had been there for centuries and only getting, as it were, more and more sinful. And Israel came in to administer God's punishment and judgment in those settings. It is awful. But the really awful thing is that people will carry on sinning until such dreadful things come about so often. Yes, in some respects the Old Testament is somewhat different. I would like to come back to that on another occasion soon. Changed by the coming of the Lord Jesus, But these principles remain, that God resists evil. The people who will assault the Jews in the month Adar, 9 months from now, they will be punished for their sinfulness. And because they are not obedient, their sins will be visited on the generations of their family too. Isn't that what we're told in the second commandment? Their line will be brought to an end. But only their line. Not the entire nation of the Jews. The Jews were restricted. They had a limited response only. And we must bear that in mind as we do come and read some of the figures that are given in chapter 9 in due course. We know from the part that Esther played that the surface conflict, she could see it. But all this time, I would suggest that this is pointing us towards a much greater matter that is God is working out, that he was then, that he continues to do. We have men who look at the problems of the world in which we live, and there's conflict, and yes, there is a tremendous amount of evil being done, one man towards another, nation against nation. And the world's wise men can take a measure of common wisdom and try and find some solutions to these problems. But we're taken right back to such days as Esther's, when so few acknowledge God. Yet God is at work. And God will not bear with evil. We know that most clearly because he has sent his son to take that evil on himself. With such background, I do hope, as I say, to come back to this, work through the rest of Esther shortly and soon, to just take up on these couple of key themes and consider them in the light of the coming of Christ, as he bears the punishment for man's sin, as he combats evil, and how we should therefore make our response as well. If Esther deals with providence, it presents the providence of God. Providence is preserving, is providing, is governing all his creatures, from Haman to Ahasuerus to Esther to the unknown, both who attack the Jews and who resist that attack. As he governs, as he provides and preserves, finally and ultimately, it is all for his glory, accomplished amongst men in his defeat of evil. This is part of that story. Close there.